Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This episode is brought to you by Paramount Plus. Get in, loser! Mean Girls is now streaming on Paramount Plus. Join Katie Heron as she meets the plastics and Tina Fey's new twist on the modern classic. Get ready for more of the rumors, backstabbing, and jokes you loved from the original movie with some fetch surprises. Rated PG-13. Wear pink and head to ParamountPlus.com to try it free.
What's going on, everybody? Hope you are having a wonderful week so far. Before we get into the podcast, I'm going to say it every week until you get bored of it. I have a Discord channel. Hit the link in the description. Come get involved. Come talk with everybody in there. It's a cool little community. Also, if you do listen to this on a regular, or if you're new to the show, please hit subscribe on whatever you're listening to, whether you're watching it on YouTube, whether you're listening on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or anything that is, just please hit subscribe. It means that the show gets bigger and we can get more interesting guests and bigger guests and kind of make this podcast into what it is turning into. I really appreciate that if you do. This week on the podcast is the one and only Model Man. I came across his music during COVID, I believe. I actually initially came across him on Instagram and listening to his videos that he was doing on there, and really interesting music, very piano driven and just interesting electronic music. He's just released an album called I Feel You Feel, which is an unbelievable musical journey of electronic music, piano music. It's just a beautiful record. So after this conversation, go listen to it. But yeah, I really enjoyed this hour and 20 minutes of just amazing conversations. So without further ado, Model Man. What is cooking, my man? How are you?
I'm pretty good. Yeah. Just chilling. Done a little bit of work this morning. How about you?
Yeah, I'm good, man. I'm good. I'm podcast deep today. It's a day of recording podcasts.
How many do you do in a day?
Well, today's the most I've done in a day. Usually I do like 3-4 and today's 5. So it's literally like nonstop. But it's good. I've got like pretty much October full of recording podcasts, and that takes me up until like February next year.
Nice. So you'll be able to have a bit of a break over Christmas.
Yeah, a bit of a break from like November and Christmas, and hopefully start recording again in January. And hopefully I can get some music finished as well in the meantime. So when podcast ends, it's like strict music studio.
Yeah.
But yeah, man.
You must have to be pretty organized to be able to like keep on top of, you know, music, DJing, and, you know, doing these podcasts as well.
Yeah, mate, I fucked myself starting a podcast. Literally, royally. Like, during COVID, when we all had, like, too much time on our hands, I started it, and it turned into what it is, so I couldn't really stop it. And I love doing it, and it kind of adds a really interesting aspect to, like, my life and career. And I get to talk to people that, like, you and I would have never have had a hour and a half long conversation in unless we got in the studio together, if you know what I mean. So it's like it gets me to talk to a load of people that I'm like really interested in, but don't have the opportunity to have those conversations, if you know what I mean, because it would just be weird if I just asked for your number and called you and spoke to you for an hour and a half on the phone. But yeah, it kind of, there is no let up of like time, realistically. It's like pretty nonstop, which can can, I don't know about you, but like it can affect a lot of things, especially on the studio side of things, because it's very regimented. But it also can really help that as well, because it's like when I go to the studio, I have to work, realistically. There's no pissing about.
Are you sort of like productive every time you're in the studio? Do you feel like, you know, every time you're in there, you're getting something?
I try to be, I have to be. Otherwise, it's like, but also in argument against that is that it's not always like exactly where I want to take things. It's just, I can just go write a club record because it's easy and I know what to do. But like, do I necessarily want to be doing that? Not all the time. No. But so it's like, it's very like functional. But I've been working differently over the last year and it's working on different projects and stuff. And it's just been nice to like set like a window in my calendar to be like, okay, this is studio, this is writing sessions, this is when I'm going to get in the studio with these people and write this, and then this is the day that I'm going to finish this record. It's interesting. What about you? How do you work your schedule?
It's weird, isn't it, like structuring creativity, because like we're in the creative world where, not to say that if you're not a musician you're not, but you know, it does sometimes feel like, because when you start making music as a kid, it's like the most freeing thing on the planet, isn't it? It's like, you just feel like playing the piano or whatever, you feel like, you know, getting behind the deck. So you do it. And it's all just based on feeling and gut instinct. And so when it becomes a job, all of a sudden, like, you've got to like try and implement some sort of structure. Otherwise, like, you're going to just be in complete chaos. Right. So, that's something that I've found difficult, just to try and, because I'm a little bit unorganized, to be quite frank. But I'm trying to get better at all those sorts of things.
How have you tried to get better? Like, what have you put in place?
Well, I've got a diary for one thing. Like, I've never had a diary in my whole life. That seems like the most basic of all things. But I've got a really good manager, and he's kind of like my diary. Like, he'll be like, Mark, this week, remember you got this or you got that or whatever. And I'm like, all right, cool. But then it got to the point where it was like, dude, you really, because he'd actually set me up a diary, like a Google Calendar or whatever, and I'd never even like logged into it. It took me like a year to even like log into it. But I've just got my head around it now, so I'm like, okay, because, you know, things started to get busier and more dates and just this, that, and the other. And I was it actually got to the point where I was sort of like missing out on stuff because I was just not organized enough. So I'm working on it.
How have you found the transition though from like being a bit more regimented with your creativity to back where you were when you weren't?
Well, it's weird because when I first started doing this project, Model Man, it was very, very unstructured. I mean, I was working full time as, you know, I was working as like a salesman, like in a music shop. And so it just wasn't like model. It was just a side hobby thing. I didn't have a studio or anything. So I was making tunes in my car. You know, or just like in my living room or whatever, or on my laptop. And so I didn't have any microphones and stuff. So to go from that, it also, like, I think like when you do that for a little while, when you've been doing that for like a couple of years, you are accustomed to that. So you've evolved in a very like idiosyncratic way, I think. So as soon as all of a sudden like you've got a studio or you've got like you know, some more like, oh, like I'm actually a proper musician or a producer, it's in a weird way it can be a little bit like overwhelming. It's like got an actual studio to go to right now, and that's sometimes like, I still find myself like, I mean, I love that I've got a space now to work in, but I also sometimes find myself making music still in the living room, like whilst watching like TV or whatever, and just, you know, which is probably a bad habit, but you know, you just, it's just how I've evolved to work in weird places, cars and trains and planes or whatever.
I respect that though, because I struggle with sitting on my laptop writing music, like just willy-nilly. I don't think I ever really have. I used to occasionally when I was on the road, like on the plane or something, I occasionally write like an edit on the plane or something like that. But yeah, like I've never really gotten into that whole, like what you're saying, just write music wherever, whenever. I really like the concept of doing it, but I just can't do it. I just haven't been able to get it in my head to do it.
Yeah, it's one of those weird things where if you can sort of, I mean, I think technology is a big factor in that, because
yeah,
it's, for me, it started with like being able to just do voice memos on a phone. So okay, I would, if I had an idea and it on the piano, it, yeah, they often come to me, I'd just put my phone out and record stuff. And then I realized like, oh, I can do that anywhere. And that will just capture little ideas and things. So I think like, you know, given how powerful a laptop is nowadays, yeah, you can do so much work just within the confines of you know, a set of headphones and like a lump of aluminium or whatever. So yeah, it's like, yeah, it's just, it for me, it's powerful. It's nice to know that if I'm in a hotel over the other in America or whatever, I can work.
Yeah.
Or if I'm in the studio at home, I can work. So it doesn't really make too much difference. I mean, the only thing is like for me, because I'm recording like a lot of acoustic instruments like piano and sometimes drums, sometimes it is nice to have a treated room, something where you can go in and like set up like proper microphones, yeah, and actually capture something the best as you can.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that. It's sometimes, but also again, having a piano in a shit room with a shit mic gives you something that you're, yeah, just worlds apart from anything else.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, at that point, like if you've got a crappy room and a rubbish out of tune piano, it's like you just get a VST and just it's going to sound better anyway. But yeah, I mean, it took me ages to get like a decent piano sound. It took, yeah, me like years of trying to figure out how to engineer it properly and how to like get a good treated room and things like that. I mean, the first like few EPs that I did, you know, you can hear like the piano sounds pretty dodgy, you know, pretty ropey.
I like that though. That's the thing. It is part of the charm, isn't it? It's like, I think it was that Skinny Love record from Birdie, the remake. And like, I like that you can hear her press the piano. You can hear her. There's a period in the song where you can hear her move on the piano stool. And there's like things like that when things are recorded perfectly, you kind of lose that character of like perfection isn't, yeah, always the best sound. It doesn't give you the most character. It doesn't give you the best feeling.
Absolutely. Like, and there's so many accidents that happen when you're doing that. I mean, like when I first started recording piano, that I quickly learned that the piano, actually like hitting the piano, sounds really good.
Yeah.
You know, because I'd like tripped over something and like probably fallen on it or whatever. But, you know, you wouldn't do that. Like, no, if you were using a VST, you don't start to understand the unique characteristics of the instrument unless you record it yourself.
Totally.
And then you start to like realize, oh, there's like loads of little nuances that I can actually hone in on. Like, whether it's like the piano movement, the pedal movement, or whether it's like how the case of the piano sounds, and like, you know, putting stuff like putting nuts and bolts, like turning it into a prepared piano or putting felt down to give it a softer sound.
Yeah.
Like all that stuff, like you don't really understand it through just using a VST.
I think also you don't really get that through using a synth. Although you get part of that, like using a hardware synth, the fact that it's like an acoustic instrument, there's just, yeah, so many, like a synth is still limiting to a certain extent.
Well, it's well you know, with a synth you're recording directly from that, yeah, you know, from that circuitry, whereas with an acoustic instrument whether it's a saxophone, violin, drums, whatever, you're recording the instrument, but also the room,
the atmosphere.
You know, so yeah. That is something to be said for the how the room sounds with combined with that instrument. I think that's what, for me, like that's what drew me to the idea of making electronic music, was be able to sort of manipulate acoustic instruments, sort of the combination of those two things, and you know, trying to make dance music with that in mind.
Yeah, and you do it amazingly. Are you classically trained at all?
Yeah, I did all the grades and all that sort of stuff. Yeah.
When did that start, when you were a kid?
Yeah. I mean, I started very young playing the piano. My mum was a piano teacher, and she actually tried to teach me piano, but I rejected her initially. I was just like, no, I just want to like do my own thing. Yeah. And I wanted to just go in there and just, I think like having dyslexia and just ADHD and all that sort of stuff, like I didn't want to have to worry about reading music. But a little bit later on, maybe, I can't remember, maybe like being 16, 17, I was like, there was things that I wanted to understand. Like there was like, I'll be hearing a Chopin piece or whatever, and I'd be like, I don't know how he's doing that.
Yeah.
And so I'd want to, so that led me to actually like, okay, right, I'm going to do it properly now. And so I learned to read music and did, you know, did all the grades and all that sort of stuff. And then I was able to understand a lot more about the theory side and get my head around that.
It's really interesting when you start looking into the theory and how it actually like helps you to play and helps you to understand music a little bit more. Like I'm not classically trained at all, and I'm not good at the keys, but I used to do theory lessons, and like it helped me massively. But also recently I've just gone back to having piano lessons, like at the bare basics. Like I have this vision in my head what I want to do, and I need to learn the piano. And it's amazing when you go back to like just the basics of like, there's something so humbling of like how bad you are at something. But it's like that journey of like, you know, you'll be good if you just keep going.
It's harder as an adult, like to learn something like the piano, because when you're a kid, you're very much in the throes of education and just learning things formally every single day, whether that's at school or whether it's like an after school club that your mum's put you in for or whatever. So it's just a natural thing. But when you're an adult and you've come out of that for a while, and maybe you've been in a full-time job, to then like learn something like the piano from scratch, it's a little bit sobering. It's kind of like hurts your ego a little bit, I think. So I think that's why it's more difficult. Yeah. But if you can get past that and just go for it, like it takes about a year to be able to read music if you do it every day.
Yeah.
As an adult or as a kid, I think if you do, it's kind of like learning a language. Like if you go to France and you want to learn French, it's probably going to take about a year. Same with music theory.
Yeah, it makes sense. When you learn it, it is, and you know it, it must be so amazing. Because I can read music to a certain level, but like I can't read to play. That's the thing I struggle with. I can read.
Yeah, it's amazing to be able to just pick up like any book, whether it's, I don't know, whatever it's Mozart or Beethoven, and then just play it.
Yeah,
it's a good. It helps me to just get like inspired as well. So like if I get up in the morning, I'm like, right, I need to work on some music. It's like I can just play through some other people's stuff for like an hour or so. Yeah. And then it just opens your eyes and your ears up to just possibilities and different harmonic things. And just, yeah, it definitely helps me. I mean, I don't think you need to have theory to be good at music. Absolutely not.
No.
You know, so most of the best musicians and best artists wouldn't be able to tell you know, what like an augmented chord looks like on paper, but it doesn't really matter, does it? It's just, you know, as long as you, if it works for me, but not for everyone.
Yeah, no, definitely. It makes sense. And I hear it in your music a lot. Do you try and always keep a piano in every record?
Yeah, I've actually got, there's piano on every single Model Man track that I've ever done. I only realized this the other day.
Well, I was listening through the album this morning. I've listened to it before, but I was listening through the album this morning. I was like, damn, he fucking loves the piano, doesn't he? And I love it. I love piano. It's my favorite.
Yeah, I think it's because that's all I had for such a long time. I just had like an old ropey upright piano, so it was just the only thing that I could use to make music on. I mean, I had my laptop, but it never felt enough, like just having like music inside there. It was, I was always drawn to the piano. And I think that's just like upbringing as well, just because there was one in the house when I was growing up. And I think so much of what your childhood is informs like the rest of your life going forward.
Massively.
Yes. Whether you like it or not. Like, I think that's why, you know, if you've had a crappy upbringing, that stuff you probably stays with you and you've got to work on to kind of overcome. And where, so for good or for worse, like, you kind of just learn to, you just adapt to what you've done.
How was your childhood?
Yeah, good. Good for the most part. I mean, up and down, I'm sure, like anyone's, but it was all right. my dad was, both my mum and dad massively into music, so it was good to have just a very musical household. Like, and so my brother, like sisters, all into music. Brother's a musician. Yeah, my dad was into like a lot of disco, Chicago house.
Sick.
So I had found a lot of his records in the loft. Mum, obviously, more into like the classical side of things. And I always felt like those two worlds were separate.
Yeah.
You know, like dance music, classical, like different. But then I realized like, actually, you know, wouldn't it be interesting to kind of try and combine those two worlds a little bit?
Yeah. And then you heard Tiesto Adagio for strings and it's game over.
And it was like game over, yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting that, isn't it? Because it's like, it feels at this moment in time, especially in the, like the UK scene, and especially with like what you're doing, there's quite a lot of other artists that are like musicians that are coming into electronic music, and it's bringing a really interesting kind of tip on what dance music is happening nowadays. There's this really interesting like musical side to dance music, which was never, or like organic musical side to dance music, which for me was never really there for a long time. And it's really interesting. You're three albums in. Is it three albums now?
Two.
Two,
but it kind of feels like more than that, because I did a few EPs before it, which were quite long.
Yeah. Okay. How do you kind of go to that album process? Is it like you wake up one day and go, I want to write an album? Or is it like you're writing a bunch of records and just kind of put it all as a package?
It's very much an album. It's very much like, okay, I'm making an album, because it's a long format. So
yeah,
you've got more space to tell a story.
Yeah.
You know, if you're just focused on one track, then it's all about that track and making maximum impact. But if you know that you've got like a few fans that are gonna actually give the whole album the time, then you know that you can just be not indulgent, but I just think you can just tell a story that just is more like expansive and can take like little ups and downs and detours and things like that. So I really like the album format. I really like that you can, you know, I mean, I wanted to have a lot more ambient weirdness on this album, but my manager and label were not too keen on that. They managed to convince me to hone it in a little bit. But so, I mean, like, because if I go down that rabbit hole, you know, you sometimes feel like, oh, I could make a concept album about like cereal or something. And then just like, before you know it, like you've completely come away from. So that's the danger of doing an album. Like, you can really go down like dark places.
Just turn into radio. Think you're Tom York and just be like, okay.
Yeah.
I feel that. But I think it's really actually interesting. Like, how do you respond to when your management and your label are like, rein it in, mate?
I normally tell them to fuck off, like initially, and then I might listen a little bit and just take it into consideration. But ultimately, I'll try and do what's in my heart, as much as possible. I mean, I'm not great at listening to people, because I don't know. Sometimes when you've got a gut instinct about something, most of the time it's right, I 100%. Think, like 9 out of 10 times. Sometimes you can be completely deluded depending on how you, your mental health is. But but yeah, you, but a lot of the time, like, I think, you know, you should go with what, how you feel, because that's how you're going to make the best music.
Mm. But in this sense, like with the album, like, was there a bunch of records that you wanted to add on, but you were like, we probably shouldn't put that on? Like, how does that work?
Well, I'd finished it. And pretty much got it to the point where I was about to submit it. It was about, I had like a few weeks left, and I'd put it to one side, essentially. I'd finished it, and then I started writing some other stuff, and I sent it. I didn't even send it. I uploaded it to SoundCloud,
yeah,
to my own like personal SoundCloud, which I didn't realize my manager has access to. And he was like, what's this then? I was like, what's what? He was like, seeing like you've uploaded a couple of tracks to SoundCloud. I was like, oh, I didn't. They're just like demos and stuff I'm messing around with. Because I use like SoundCloud as like a journal in a way, like a musical journal. And he said, oh, well, by the way, I just sent it to your label. I was like, oh, well, great. Like, that wasn't ready to be consumed. And they were like, and they want it to be the single, the lead single. And I'm like, what? It was called Start Again, the song. Which is like the track that, just came out with the album. And anyway, so they just said, we really like it. I mean, it was half finished as well at the time. So they were like, but you've got to finish it in like 2 weeks to kind of get the, you know, in terms of like getting the album delivery and all that. So I'm like, right, okay, I guess I better finish it. So there was two tracks like that. So I basically like had to finish two tracks in the space of 2 weeks, which was a bit stressful. So it's crazy, but there you go.
I think that's the amazing thing though, isn't it? Is like sometimes when you have a team around you that's like a little more stepped away from the actual creative process and can like hear it with a different perspective, it can literally, it can really help our creativity.
I think you need that. I think you need that from, whether it's from a friend or a label or a manager or whoever it is, I think you do need an outsider's like objective opinion.
Yeah.
Because you can be very immersed in your own world and not realize like that you, because the amount of like friends and producers that I've got that have made a track and they're like, I was just messing around with this or whatever. Like, this is like my worst track, or like, this is a joke.
Yeah.
And everyone else is like, this is your best track.
Yeah, literally.
Like, that happens an awful lot, because sometimes if you don't put, maybe you're just more relaxed or you're just messing around, and like that brings out another side to your creativity and your persona that sometimes is like really compelling for other people, because for whatever reason, you're just, it's a more affable piece of music, and people are just drawn to it because it's, maybe you just didn't care so much and you did it quickly or whatever. And it just captured a great little moment in time.
I totally agree. I was literally just talking to Dot from London Grammar about this on the podcast before, and we were saying exactly the same thing. And there's sometimes when you just catch a vibe and everyone loves it, and it's you almost like, I've done it multiple times with me where I just like question myself. I'm like, why are they into this? It's like, this is not like musical genius, this is just the simplest thing I've ever done, and I could do this over and over again. But like, the crux of it always, I couldn't do it over again because it was literally that moment in time and that vibe that we just captured, and there's nothing you can do about it, but it just seems to connect, which is super interesting. With the whole album process, do you, because I talk, going back from the beginning with you like being more structured in your life and you being creative, when you decide that you're going to write an album, do you set a deadline?
I try. Well, not initially. Like, when, I think you need to let things just happen naturally and just start like the creative and get ideas. And I think you don't want to be thinking so much about like deadlines and stuff like that, for me personally. So, but once things start to form a little bit and you're like, oh, like, this actually feels like maybe a small body of work is happening or something. Like, there's for me, like the first thing that I did for the album was a song called Arms. And as soon as I did that, I realized like what I wanted. I had a complete vision for an album. So after I'd sort of finished that song, then it was like, okay, I can actually see a light at the end of the tunnel with this project. And therefore, like, I think I might have something in 5 months' time or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And then you say, like, okay, to your management or label or whatever it is, your team, I think I can deliver something around this time. And then they'll say, okay, well, we'll start structuring, thinking about the campaign and, yeah, and bringing people together and looking to that date. And then as the months roll on, you can obviously, like, ascertain, like, okay, am I, like, going to hit this target? And then you can, like, you communicate with your team and they're like, you know, how are you getting on? Like, do you think, that's how it works for me. I've always, every single time, had to, like, stretch out, like, the deadline. I never just get there early. It's yeah. always like, you know, a push and I need another month or yeah. whatever it is. Cause I'm just, yeah, I'll end up, you know, scrapping the whole thing or whatever.
Really? Is that your vibe?
I'll have at least like two or three complete like meltdowns where I feel like I need to scrap everything and like, you know, burn all the tapes or whatever. But I normally come out of it like after I've had a walk or whatever and some food. But I think it's very, very difficult to make an album. That's one thing I've learned. I think like because I've only made two albums now, but the first album, I remember it was in lockdown and it was very, very challenging because for me, like going out, whether it's like playing, producing, DJing or with other people, bouncing off of people,
yeah.
that gives me energy and vibes and stuff. And so when it was in lockdown, I was trying to make a record like completely isolated, it just felt so difficult. And now when I listen back to that album, I'm like, oh, this is very dark. Like there's moments on it that just feel like really, just like I wasn't in a good place.
But is that not like a diary of who you were at that time?
It is. It's just, yeah, it's just, you know, it, like I can't really listen to it now. Like,
really?
Because it just makes me, yeah, it makes me just feel like there was like dark times, you know? Whereas like, yeah, this new album just feels more like the album that I wanted to make. And, you know, I feel like I just had all the ingredients in my life to make something that I wanted to make. Whereas I felt like there was just things missing with that first album, which is why, you know, maybe it's just not like the perfect depiction of Model Man, but it probably was in that moment, if that makes sense.
What are the ingredients in your life you need to make the album that you've made? Now
I feel like, well, firstly, I mean, it's difficult to say what those exact ingredients are because they're probably different for each record, but the thing that really like ignited it for me was performing again and like being able to go out to clubs or whatever. And just like, so as soon as like lockdown like lifted and I was out, I remember like playing in Manchester, a club called Yes Bar, and it was just so exhilarating. Like it was so like crowd were going nuts and it was just, I had a really good night. And you know, that week I remember just like coming back, just like full of energy and just wrote, you know, like three or four new ideas. And yeah, it just felt like, oh, I think I didn't realize it because I'm an introvert, but I actually need people in my life. Like I need like to bounce off of people and I need to experience like things.
Yeah.
You know, I need to like go out and have new experiences, whether that's like traveling or whether it's like just going out with friends or whatever it is. I need that in my life. Like, and some, and I didn't think I did, but it wasn't until like after lockdown that I realized that I did.
It's really,
that was the first ingredient.
It's really interesting you say that because I think like saying yourself as an introvert, I kind of learned this probably like a year ago. I was listening to a podcast and it was purely based on the meaning of introvert and extrovert. And like, I didn't know this. But for me, because I would class myself as an introvert as well. And it was very apparent that like, we all still need those things in our lives. Like we need the friends around us. We need, but it's more so about having closeness to people and like a connection with people. Whereas like, an extrovert is like out partying a lot. Like we'll go to the after party and we'll be just happily just not know anyone and just get involved. Whereas for me, like you won't catch me an after party unless like my best friend is going with me, or you'll catch me like I'd rather have three really close friends. But then the minute somebody else comes in on that that I don't know, I can like go down into myself and become like a bit quieter and reserved. And it was really interesting because it was like what we do as a living is very extrovert, right? Like playing in front of hundreds of thousands of people, like it's very, it seems like we're all extroverts, but a lot of us aren't. A lot of us are just a bunch of weirdos. They're just but there is that importance of like, for even for me, is like I'm pretty regimented with like seeing friends and family because I need that in my life. I need to have that connection, the like feeling of love, like that kind, which I think we all need. But like if I spend a week in the studio and I don't see anyone, by the end of that week the music I'm making is fucking awful.
Right.
Same with like DJing, same with podcasts, everything. If I don't have that like time with loved ones, friends, family, I really just go down into like some weird darkness. It's very, or like what I'm trying to create doesn't come out as good as what it would if I had that time to breathe. But I guess it's just having time out of the workspace, I guess, as well, which is healthy.
Yeah, it was a strange time, wasn't it? Looking back now, God, thank goodness we're out of it and like we can go out again and just have fun and see people.
What's the second ingredient?
The second ingredient, I think, is like having some source of inspiration that is not necessarily like another human being, but like a thing. Mm. It might be something philosophical, or it might be maybe it's like a muse or someone that is dead or whatever, like a poet or what, something that just inspires you like beyond yourself. Like for me, it was probably like film in a weird sort of way. Like there was a few films that I was watching at the time. I was watching like loads of Stanley Kubrick, and which obviously like he's a great, everyone's seen all his films and stuff, but I remember watching Eyes Wide Shut, which is a really weird film, and there's loads of space in that film where there's just like, it feels like nothing's really happening, and there's like no music, there's like one piano note or whatever. And that was like quite an inspiration for me, because it was just just like having space in the music and just how, you know, telling a story in a very sort of like a minimal way, but honing in on one like singular thing. So that was a bit of a like a light bulb moment for me, like with this album, because I was like, oh, I want to write some stuff that is like very like singular ideas, that is like minimal stuff happening. So that was like another thing, like film, I guess, for me. What else? Yeah, I mean, like all of his films. I did like a marathon of like all of his films. And like Eyes Wide Shut, I think is his last film.
I don't think I've ever seen that.
It's got Nicole Kidman and Tom Cruise in it.
Okay.
And they're at their peak as well. That's like 90s Tom Cruise, like looking brilliant. Buff. I think like the actual, it starts like the opening sequence is like Nicole Kidman, like completely naked, like getting dressed. So if there's any, like, you know, if you want to watch a film, then, you know, that's, I'm giving you a good reason to watch it. But and then like what, I can't remember what came before that, but yeah, I mean, there's like Clockwork Orange, The classic. Shining, 2001 Space Odyssey.
I've never watched The Shining.
So good.
I'm really
so
like
scary as well.
Yeah, that's the thing. I'm not into like, I know it's not a horror, but like it also is to a certain, it's more of like a thriller.
I'd say it's a horror.
Yeah.
I'd say it's a horror because I think that what's cool about Kubrick is that he's made the best film in every genre. Like, yeah. He's made the best sci-fi film ever, 2001 Space Odyssey.
Yeah.
He made the best horror ever, The Shining. Like, not many people can say that.
Have you watched The New Shining?
Some great... Huh?
Have you watched The New Shining?
I haven't. Oh, with Ewan McGregor?
Yeah.
I've heard good things about it, but I haven't got around to watching it yet. I need to give it a go.
Yeah, I need to. Yeah. I do need to watch him. Like, I was at my mate's house and The Shining. She had the book on it on the side, and I was like, "It's still. I really can't stand horrors. I'm like the biggest pussy when it comes to horrors. Like, just can't do it." But it's like a cult classic, isn't it? Now it's just like something you have to watch.
Yeah, there's so many iconic moments with like Jack Nicholson and stuff. You know,
yeah.
with his axe and all that sort of stuff. Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, I love that. The whole process of signing the album, were you signed before, or was this like a write the album, sign it, release it?
So I actually signed to, so I'd made Arms, so I had like a demo of one track, I think, and that got me signed to a label called Helix.
Yeah.
The intent that I would make an album. So then I got to work on the, so after I'd done that track, I think I had one other track as well with Baklava. Yeah, that was it. I'd done a song with Baklava.
She's great.
Obviously great, great vocalist, great writer. So I had those two songs and they signed me on the back of that and let me make this album.
Amazing.
And now they're probably like, why did we do that? It's given us like a load of weird music after that. Like, they were like the two more accessible songs, and then the rest of it is like pretty weird.
Yeah, but you know what? Like, there's, for me, that's the whole point of having an album, right? You have like,
yeah.
You have the album singles, but it goes back to what you were saying is like, what do you want your fans to think of you as? And is... Yes, you can write hit records all day long if you want, right? Or you can try to. We don't know if they're going to be a hit record. But realistically, is that what you want your fans to think of you? Like, is that... Or do you want your fans to be able to, like, actually listen to the album and, like, enjoy going through that, like, emotional journey and musical journey of who you are as a person? And an artist.
Oh, absolutely. Like, I've always wanted to create a world that people can kind of come into, like, yeah. My world, which is Model Man, that doesn't, I don't want to just be sitting on playlists with other stuff. I want people to like come to me and like actually get stuck into an album. Absolutely. Like, I've always wanted that. And I've never tried to, I'm going to write a hit. I've just never had that mentality. Yeah. It's always just been like, just make music as organically as I possibly can, like just make music that I want to make and hopefully people will come to it and get what I'm trying to do.
Do you ever switch through where you're like, I wish I could just write hit records?
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
I think it's a very specific skill set. And I think it's very different nowadays because you have multiple writers on every single record. Yeah. Like there'll be one girl or guy or them or they that's doing a top line. And then there'll be another person that's like doing drum production. And then there'll be another, like there's so many, or they'll all be in the same room working on it together. Like it's a very collaborative thing now, whereas like say back in probably like more like the 70s and 80s, like, you would have a band that would be, there would be one or two, like, chief writers that would just be like the Bee Gees or whatever. Like, they'd be just churning out hit after hit. You know, it's very different now. So, yeah, I think, like, I'm happy with the thing that I've got, which is just to, like, make little piano motifs and, like, cut up vocals and stuff. Like, I wouldn't change that. I wouldn't want to, because if I was just a hit maker, I'd be something completely different. It wouldn't be Modern Man. It would be, you know, whatever else. But I think it's a great skill to have. Like, if you can go in and just write, like, this thing that's going to translate to everyone. I think you need to be able to, like, do something that the masses are going to like, which isn't always easy. But when you do that, when you write something that the masses like, then there's going to be those, you're going to eliminate or isolate, like, the idiosyncratic audience that maybe, like, someone like me has built. So I've always got to be careful with that, because throughout my career, I've been very strongly, like, encouraged to collaborate. Like, you need to get, like, guest vocalists, like, collaborate. And I've, for the most part, I've kind of pushed back on that.
Yeah.
Because I knew that if I did that, and if I invite, like, I've created a delicate ecosystem, and if I start bringing loads of people into it, it disrupts that, and it changes what it is fundamentally. So I've got to be very careful about who I just invite to collaborate with. Like, I'm not that sort of artist. I'm not like a, right, I'm going to go and do like 50 sessions like this month and just like churn out loads of music. It's I'm a much more sensitive person than that. Like, I can't get my head around that.
Yeah. It's interesting, isn't it? Because I think what you've built is you've built a really solid foundation of listeners, followers that kind of just love what you do. And the minute you step away or kind of veer off that kind of path, it's like, do you alienate them or do they go with you? And it's kind of the scary thing with being an artist, as much as it sounds weird saying that, but it's like, you don't know. Sometimes it might be like career decision, right? Like, it might be financially better off veering off, right? But then once you've veered off and you've lost this, you've lost a percentage of the initial foundation of fans. When you veer off and gain more fans, do they stay with you when you go back to what you were doing, or do they stay with you when you veer off again? And it's that kind of like catch 22 I think everybody gets into at some point in their career. It's like, when do you ever make that transition? Because there's artists that don't, and they just keep doing what they're doing, and they just happen to like have massive hits, but by accident. Like, let's say, for instance, Chemical Brothers, right? Like, Chemical Brothers have done, like, their new album, like, realistically, it's just a Chemical Brothers album. I fucking love it. It's amazing. Yeah. But I love it because I'm a fan. But I can, my views is, if I wasn't a fan and didn't know what they've done in the past and didn't kind of grow up with them and then listen to that new album straight off the back, would I be like, this is fucking amazing, if you know what I mean? But my view is this is fucking amazing because I love the Chemical Brothers, and this is exactly what I want with a Chemical Brothers album. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely. It's weird because, like, if you look at someone like Chemical Brothers or even like The Prodigy,
yeah,
you know, they, like, The Prodigy kind of like just ignited at a very perfect moment, didn't they? Like, in the 90s. So I remember when they had, because there was a, what was the album? I think it was like Music for the Jilted Generation, where you had like Start the Dance, and Poison, and like so many great tracks. And I remember thinking, like, well, it can't get any better than that, can it? Like, Poison, like, is just,
it's amazing,
mind blowing.
Yeah,
and then like Heath Flint all of a sudden was like the lead vocalist.
Mm-hmm.
Who'd basically been a dancer for the entire career of The Prodigy or whatever, and like took to lead vocals. They'd become this almost like a punk dance band, and they released Firestarter and Breathe in like 1997 or whatever it was.
Yeah,
and just, and that one was like number one in the charts. Like,
that on like the
for about land? Like, you wouldn't have predicted that, would you, with like Prodigy, like, well, given what their first album was, like, compared to like the Fat of the Land. But it's mad how that can happen. I think that's a great example of like a band just having this very unique trajectory and then just like igniting and going crazy in the in that moment in time, because they'll never have that again.
No.
I mean, obviously, sadly, like Keith Flint's obviously passed and stuff, but yeah, just fascinating, like, to how that unfolded, like, because there was this. Is it Liam Hewlett, isn't it? Or is that how you pronounce his name?
I don't know.
It was like, the guy that basically like produces and writes everything.
Yeah.
It was just him for like, he was producing everything, like writing everything. And he just got those other guys in, Leroy, Maxim and Keith, as basically dancers.
Liam Howlett.
Because Liam Howlett. So they were basically all the raves like in the early 90s, and he was like, I could do some dances. Do you want to like come and dance or whatever? And so they should be dancing on stage going nuts. And it's just fascinating how it just become a band.
Yeah.
Like, when has that ever happened? I can't think of another example.
It's the same with Faithless. That's how Faithless started.
With
Faithless, Maxi, from what I gathered, and I could be wrong, but Maxi Jazz wasn't part of Faithless to start with. Faithless was Sister Bliss and Rolo.
That's right,
And then they just sent these records to Maxi and was like, can you rap over this? And he did. And
that's so mental.
There you have God as a DJ and Insomnia. And you're just like, it's there's something so organic about that, though, which I feel like nowadays, I don't know if that would necessarily happen because that we know there's such a commerciality to music. We know there's such a big music business, where back then, especially in electronic music, it wasn't really a thing. It was a rave culture. That's all it was.
Yeah.
It was just fucking raves. Drop some gurners and just rave. Whereas now it's very different from that. I'd like to think it would happen. I guess in a slightly sideway, you've got what Fred has done with Fred Again, where like he's created his own. Sorry, my camera's just gone absolutely special. Let me just switch cameras. My camera keeps like turning off at the moment. It's really fucking annoying. I guess that's more so the modern day vibe of someone blowing up, is you get what you've got out of Fred Again or Skrillex.
Yeah, where they've done, like, they've sampled people on Instagram or whatever, like singer songwriters and stuff, and then just done.
Yeah, it's like,
yeah, like turned day. Into a dance tune.
Yeah, it's like the modern day of that, but it's still very different. There's still something not like, there's still something like, I don't know what the word is without sounding disrespectful to what the modern day is to compare to what it was. There's something that feels so much more raw about
it. It's just different, isn't it? Like you'll never be able to recreate what was happening in the 90s, because there was, well, for one thing, it was very, very new. Like a lot of those genres of music were just incredibly new.
Yeah.
And also there was no social media or like phones or anything. So people were getting together and it was very much about the music for one thing, and people just having a good time and the drugs as well. But it's just very different.
Yeah. Do you think it will ever come back around like that? Do you ever think there'd be something else that comes out of that?
I don't think so. I just think like it's impossible to have that in the same way. Like I think like with social media, it's just impossible now. Mm. I mean, there are still raves happening. Like I stumbled upon one like recently, and there's like in Hackney, there's a few that just pop up in the woods and things. But which are great. But you know, like in the 90s, like you would get like a message or whatever, or like there'll be like a phone call or whatever. It's like, all right, it's going to be here or whatever, and then like people will be just racing to get to this random location, getting lost, like police showing up, and also it's pretty nuts, really.
I tried to do it in Detroit. We did like a party a few years ago. I think this is pre-COVID actually, and it was like, text this number to get the location, and there was just a vibe about the party that was just so different to what you normally get when you're trying to sell tickets.
Cool.
It's cool. What was the party like? It was wicked. It's fucking wicked. It was because we couldn't actually announce the venue because it was in the, it was like an illegal venue. Like you couldn't physically announce it. So it was fun. But it's also very hard to run a business like that.
Yeah.
Realistically. And I think that's the crux of what we do compared to what happened then. It was, wasn't necessarily a business at that time.
Yeah, no, that's you're exactly right. Yeah, it was, there wasn't any money objectives, was there? It was just right, we just want to throw a great party.
Yeah, and it was all like free party culture was crazy, but realistically the people that were making money and throwing the parties were drug dealers and they would make the money on the pills.
Yeah.
Which is like, my parents own a drug and alcohol rehab, and I remember speaking to, I can't say who it is, but one of the guys that used to run these parties, and he was in their rehab.
Oh, he
was like one of the like head drug dealers in this party. And that, like, they would go around in like convoys in the 90s, just like convoys down like the motorway, down like the M4 and M5. And they just park up and just throw a rave. And they'd be like smuggling drugs from Amsterdam and taking them back over. Like crazy stories. And yeah, I guess you just can't get away with that anymore. It's just, promoters have to be pretty legit. And
well, it's just there's a faster spread of information and you can monitor things a lot easily. Like, you know, everyone's got a phone, someone can document it, and all of a sudden, like, oh, like they shouldn't be there. Like, and the police will show up a lot quicker than they would back in the 90s, where there was, you just couldn't spread that information as quickly.
Yeah, it's definitely, definitely different. Can't complain. We've got it good at the moment as well, let's be honest.
Yeah, it's pros and cons. And I'm sure, like, I mean, I'm obviously too young to be able to remember any rage or anything, but I reckon, like, it was probably pretty rough in places as well. Yeah.
I went to one free rave, not like years ago. I used to date a girl that loved free parties, and I went to one and I was like, I do not want to go to another one of these. Like, it was not my scene at all. It was just like hard house and people like on another level of fucked up. Like, this is like zombies. But we've all seen those videos, haven't we, on YouTube of like old rave and people being interviewed. And you're like, I need, like, it would have been hilarious to be in there. Have you seen the DVS1 interview on Resident Advisor?
I haven't.
You should check that out. I'll send it to you after. It's fucking amazing. Do you know who DVS1 is?
I know who he is, but yeah.
He used to put on parties in, I think, Ohio in the UK, in the US. And he did this like iconic rave. I'll send you it. It's, anybody that's listening, go watch it, because it's an amazing documentary. Cool. How do you translate your music on a live sense? Because I've never seen you live. I've never really kind of, I didn't know that was a big thing of what you did. So how do you do that?
It took me a little while. Initially, before COVID lockdown, I had this idea that I wanted to put on a show with a full band.
Yeah.
So I got like my friend playing drums. I had like my brother playing vocals, like all the vocal samples on like a little sampler in real time. And then I had another guy playing like synth bass and stuff. And it was really, really good. It was really, really good fun. Yeah. And then we put on one show and it was sold out. It was like, we played in Hackney, Studio 1994. And everyone's like, this is amazing. Like, when are you going to play next? And then it was like, boom, lockdown. And then after lockdown, I realized, because I applied for an American visa.
Yeah.
And it's expensive to get to America. So I was, it just dawned upon me. I was like, there's no way this is going to be sustainable to be able to like get three other guys and me out touring America or wherever it is, paying for all their visas, paying for hotels. I was like, what am I doing? Like, this is great, but it's too ambitious at this stage. Mm. So I got my piano.
Yeah.
And my, so like a digital piano.
Yeah.
And then just did yeah, like beats with the piano, like so I could do like live looping and stuff, trigger different scenes and manipulate stuff in real time and just develops a completely different live show where it's just me playing piano essentially and kind of like DJing, like sort of a hybrid thing. And that's gone down really, really well. So I've just been working on that and it's been evolving and growing. And so I'm doing some shows like next year in February, doing a few European things and a few dates in the UK and stuff. So I'm excited about that.
Mate, you'll have to tell me those dates. I'd love to come to one. It'd be amazing to see.
Yeah, of course.
Really, really good to see that. Is the bigger like vision to have the band?
I think the music's changed a lot since then. It's become probably a little bit more clubby. Some of it, not all of it. It's still quite chill, I think, in many respects. But there was like when I put that band together, a lot of the records that I was making were more like I was playing loads of live drums and stuff. So it actually made sense to have a live drummer. Whereas there's like on this record that I've just made, there's a lot less of that.
Yeah.
So I think going out and playing in clubs has informed a little bit how I've made this next record. So at the moment, it doesn't really make sense to put a band together. But maybe, like, you know, I never rule anything out. Mm. You know, in the future, you know, for like a one-off show, it might be kind of cool to do, like what like Bonobo does, like brings a whole band together. And I think that would be fun.
It's really interesting because I view you more as a live artist than a DJ, and that's not me being disrespectful.
Yeah.
It's purely me like actually loving your music and wanting to envision and wanting to see that as a live show, rather than just be chucked on a lineup as between another two DJs. Cause your music feels like it needs to be kind of presented in a live sense, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. I've always felt like that as well. Like I've wanted to do, I mean, the performance aspect is something that just, I think that's in your blood a little bit, like where you actually want to play. I think, but just because I've played piano my whole life, like playing just comes, it feels like a natural thing for me. I wanted to have something where I could just like perform, play the piano, sequence different things and that, but. Yeah, I like DJing as well, but it feels like quite a different thing.
Yeah, it is two completely different things. But I guess if you can add both to it and then kind of make it more of a hybrid. It could make it. I just played with Carl Cox at Red Rocks this weekend.
And, oh, wow.
And
cool.
He's doing like a hybrid live set, which is really interesting how he's doing
I've seen some of this, yeah.
It's fucking cool.
He's got loads of, like, he's got, like, what is that sampler thing that he's got? I can't remember what it's called. Like, Topaz or something? Yeah, I can't remember. But
Pioneer Topaz.
Is that it? Yeah. He's got a crazy setup.
Yeah, it's mental. So I've just had him on the podcast. So by the time this comes out, would have come out. And him and Christopher Coe. Do you know who Christopher Coe is?
No.
So Christopher Coe is old school producer legend guy in like techno.
Okay.
But he's like hardware king. Like just everything he does is hardware. He set up a label with Carl that is like live music hardware only. Like they don't allow any like producers that are just writing stuff in the door. Like it has to be live. Fucking genius.
Cool.
Carl brings him on tour to kind of like set up all of his hardware stuff. And yeah, they have, I think he uses like the Topaz, he uses like a drum machine. He also has like the DFAM, the like Moog DFAM. It's really interesting how it's all done. But I saw a lot of the show the other night and it was definitely different to a DJ show. And
yeah,
just adds a level of flavor of like, you can have a synth just running for like 10, 15 minutes of doing the same thing, but like it just kind of glues it all together for me rather than just one track, another track, another track, another track as a DJ.
So is he performing, like, is it all his own stuff or is he playing like other people's tunes? Like, how is he doing
it? I think he's doing both. So I think he's playing some other people's records and then just making stuff on the fly.
Wow. That's so cool.
It's fucking wicked.
Yeah, I'd love to see that.
It's wicked. And it's really interesting, like we spoke about it on the podcast, that like he's been doing it for 40 odd years and he's still trying to like push things forward. He's still doing stuff that nobody else is doing. And you're just like,
yeah, he's a legend.
That's how you keep going. But I guess like what's the, not the end goal, but what's the next goal for Model Man? Because the album's fucking good, man. Like, I've got to say, it's really fucking good. And especially nowadays, to hear a cohesive album like that, where it's not like just a bunch of singles that somebody's put together and call it an album. Like, to hear a cohesive album of electronic music, it's very hard nowadays because labels don't like releasing albums. Artists don't know how to write albums. Album culture is not a thing anymore compared to what it used to be. Like, how do you move forward from that? How do you grow from that?
So I've actually been working on something that is called, I've called it Preludes for People, and it's a series of like solo piano pieces.
Yeah,
that is like dedicated to different people that I've had in my life.
Wow.
And yeah, so the first one I actually released a while ago is called Ross. It's just, you can find it on my Spotify or Apple or whatever. And it's just solo piano a piece that's like a late friend of mine that passed away like way too soon, like that had a massive effect on me. And that was how it started. And then since I've been just slowly, like over time, I've been writing them, and I've got about 15 now. And so I'm just putting that into, I'm going to probably like release it as like a two-part like album or an EP.
Yeah.
Like one maybe I think in like February and then another one later on in the year. But so that's what I'm kind of working on at the moment. And I'm also like, I've got my shows coming up. I'm working on my DJing as well. I'm playing with LF System.
Yeah.
In Brooklyn in a couple of weeks, actually, like November. So yeah, just getting my head around that. And yeah, musically, I'm always working on bits and pieces. I'm doing some remixes and stuff like that. But yeah, so that's kind of where my head's at. But I mean, I'd love to be able to just be in a position where I can keep making albums, because I do really like that format. I think it's exciting to me. Like EPs are cool as well, but like there's something about an album that just feels like this big, like you're putting yourself really, like you're putting yourself out into the world, like saying like, this is what I'm all about. Like this has been the last like 18 months of my life or a year of my life, whatever it is. And I think it takes a lot of courage as well to put out an album, because you don't know if it's going to be received well. You don't like people, like you say, like we're living in a world of like TikTok and Instagram where people are not listening to albums realistically. Some people are, like some people, I mean, I've actually been surprised by the amount of like response I've had from this album. Like people are saying like, you know, it's like one of their favorite albums of the year so far. And like, and saying like, they've actually they're listening to the whole thing. And like, where's the vinyl? So it's encouraging, because it makes me think, oh, maybe people do still care about the album.
I think people are coming back to that format. I think people are coming back to it because I think there was a culture, like, how old are you?
29.
Yeah. So like, even when, like, I'm similar to HD, like growing up, we listened to albums. We had that one album in our car and listened to it forever on a CD because that's all we had. Right. And it wasn't all music wasn't available to us then. But like, I think that culture's slowly coming back because I think people want more. I think people are finding artists and then want to hear more of them and want to kind of grow with the artists and like be fans rather than fans of a song. Yeah. And you're 100% right. Like the whole album thing is like, it's putting yourself out there in the like the rawest form as an artist, in my view.
Yeah.
And
absolutely.
I think, tell me if you agree or disagree, but like, I think it's also gives people something to be excited about. Like if I know my favorite band is bringing an album out, I can't fucking wait. If they're bringing a single out, I'm like, cool. Like I'm going to listen to it, but like an album, I can spend time on that album. And
yeah,
for me, it like gives me a different perspective of that artist as well. It's like, oh, they're into this, they're into that. And I don't know, it's just something different about it.
I think, do you know what, as well, I think something really exciting to me, because when all said and done and you look back on time and what's happened in musical history, there's only so many like truly brilliant records that were made. Like, yeah, you know, when you look at like all-time great lists, there isn't, it's actually really difficult to make a great album.
Yeah.
And so I think it's really exciting if you can discover an artist and you discover an album that's like really great.
Yeah.
Like something that is coming out in 2023 or 2024. And it's like, oh my goodness, this is actually like a brilliant album. Yeah. Like that's an exciting thing because it's not an easy feat to accomplish.
I totally agree. I totally agree. How do you name your album? I know it's like quite a bait question, but your album is I Feel You Feel.
Yeah, it's called that's it. Yeah, yeah. It's called I Feel You Feel. Yeah. So
which the to idea me is behind a, that. Sorry to butt in, but it's a beautiful saying that, and I love that.
Thank you.
For me, that kind of means something else to me. But like, what does that mean to you?
Well, first of all, like the phrase is circular, so it feels like it can go round and round, and that was the idea with like sequencing electronic and dance music, because it is about, it's about the loop, and it's, you know, it's about that. So that was the first thing, but more importantly, the actual concept behind it is, so I Feel You Feel, it's about like the passing of energy, like from one person to another. So yeah, it's like about when you feel something, whether you're DJing and you want to communicate that to the audience, like if you feel that emotion, it's like the hope that you can translate that into other people.
Yeah.
That was the kind of concept behind it.
I love that. How long did it take you to get to that?
It was really soon. I had the idea after I'd done like the first track on the album, and I'd had the title like very, very early on. Mm. And it just kind of, yeah, just went from there.
It's a fucking wicked title. Like I didn't notice it until literally like half an hour ago, I'll be honest. Like, or when before,
we
were talking, and like, there's like album names that I'm like, oh yeah, that's cool. But there's certain like album names that like are just fucking amazing. And it just adds to, for me, it adds to the story. It adds to the, like the tangible kind of physicality of a record. That like, you know, when you're like a kid and you like got a vinyl or you got a CD and you like could open it up and like read the lyrics and everything like that. And yeah, like the fact that like an album name is like iconic, you just like love it. Like for me, like I know it's kind of controversial to talk about him, but like Kanye was one of the best at that, of like album concepts and album names. Like what was his last one that not...
Because he did one that had, what do you mean, the one where he did like the gospel choir stuff? No,
so that's one of my that's one of my favorite albums. That was called Jesus. Yeah, yeah. That's called Jesus is King. But the Yay album, when it's like, it's called Yay, but on the cover it's like, I hate being bipolar, it's awesome. Like,
that's so good. Like, that's great, isn't it?
So good. And you just like, there's something so iconic about that, like, even like the Chemical Brothers. Or like Faithless, Outrespective for me was just like, Outrespective isn't really a word. There's no like, for me, like there's not really a true meaning behind what the actual it is, but there was just something amazing about it. Like the new one, what's the new Chemical Brothers album called? Yeah, for the Beautiful Feeling. Like there's just, for me, I just listen to these, I just read these and I'm like, it's going to make me feel warm inside, which is what I want for like when I listen to an album.
Yeah, Kanye West was masterful at that, creating all those different concepts and stuff. He wrote a track on, or produced a track on Jay-Z's, I think it's the Black Album. Mm. I can't remember what the song's called now, but I remember really liking it at the time. Oh, God damn it. What is the song called? I'm going to find out.
I'm Googling it now. Kanye West produced Jay-Z Black Album. Let's see what it is.
What's it called? I'm going to find out because it's going to bug the hell out of me. But yeah, it basically, he wrote this song. And oh, hold on. Where is it?
Produce of Jay-Z. Was it on the Blueprint?
Oh, yeah, it might have been. Oh, no, no, no. Sorry. It was on the Black album. It's called Encore.
Okay. Yeah.
It's called Encore. It's a really good track. It's sort of probably one of the more sort of lesser known tracks off that album.
Yeah, I don't know that record. I'll have to check it.
Anyway, so like, this is so weird. This is how like weird publishing is. So I remember like looking to see who'd written this track, yeah. Encore, because I really liked it. I was like, I wonder how like Kanye produced it and stuff. And I looked at the writing credits and it said Paul McCartney.
Mm.
I was like, Paul McCartney, like what was he doing in the studio in the 90s with Kanye West and Jay-Z? and because that was like just what I pictured had happened.
Yeah.
And then I looked into it a little bit more, did a bit of like detective work on it. And I realized like, oh, he wasn't in the studio at all. They'd actually sampled something. And I was like, right, really? What Beatles song have they sampled? Because I can't hear it in this. And I know the Beatles music pretty well. And it turns out that they'd sampled a Beatles track that was covered by like some old salsa band. So it was like this really like weird idiosyncratic way of getting to this song. So like it was, but the, here's what's even crazier. The salsa band that had covered this Beatles song, it was the intro that Jay-Z and Kanye had actually sampled, which had no like resemblance on the original Beatles song.
Wow.
So, like, in a way, like, technically, yeah, like, he's got that credit, but he didn't actually write any of this stuff. Yeah. So, Paul McCartney's got a credit for Jay-Z's Encore, which is so weird.
And then on that record, Jay-Z then went to Linkin Park and made it a Linkin Park collab.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Crazy. Yeah, to be fair, Kanye on production was just, like, one of my favorites, like.
I love those old videos where he's in the studio just with like an MPC player, and he's you just know that he's a genius because he's got like the one record and he's made like a whole track out of like a tiny little segment, and he's just in there like pressing like his MPC.
Yeah,
it's like, well,
yeah. Sadly, all of his political views has just gone a bit skew-whiff and everything else, but.
Yeah, well, yeah, we won't go there.
Yeah, but like as an artist, but again, like I think there's also a level talking about limitations in the studio, is like back then when they were writing, there wasn't splice, there wasn't like all these options. Yeah. That like there was realistically like with Jay-Z and that, there was a lot of options because they had the money, right? They had the hits, but like even their like newer albums, they felt like there's still a level of like limitation of like, okay, let's go get an Otis Redding record and let's make a fucking, let's take an amazing record and make another amazing record out of it. And then you've got Otis by Kanye and Jay-Z. And you're like,
yeah.
I remember when listening to Zane Lowe play that for the first time, I think he had like the world exclusive on it. And you're just like, okay, I love that Otis Redding record so much. Like, Otis Redding was, like, my childhood. And then you hear that, and, you, like, sometimes when you hear somebody sample something that you have such good memories to, you're like, fuck off. Like, I don't want to hear that again. Pretty much all of the music that gets released nowadays at this moment in time, like, it's you listen to it, and you're like, you've done that in such a shit way.
Yeah.
Like, you've done that just to make a hit record, where, like, they've done it to just, like, make great art. And you're just like, how did... Like, just to be in the studio and be able to, like, stand back and go see their vision, I think, is really interesting.
That was that period of time. I think there was a very, very high art form in terms of sampling.
Yeah.
But the techniques and just the vision that they would have, like, Jay Dilla, like, is one that comes to mind. The way that he was sampling those records and making something new is just staggering. You're like, oh, how did he get from A to B there? Yeah. I just don't get that. But yeah, like that, I think that's lost probably a little bit more now because people are scared to sample because it's difficult to clear samples. But back then it was a new thing and people were sampling whatever the hell they wanted and didn't care.
I think the I listened to something actually the other day where I'd push back on what you just said personally, purely because I listened to this thing and I'd never really thought about it. There was a period in time when it was really hard to sample, like, because you could never clear it. But especially in the last like 2-3 years, all these publishing companies and all these labels have realized, fuck, we can make a shit ton of money out of amazing records. And like, it's crazy what's being sampled, uncleared, being released, and then the labels going, okay, we can release this and make this a hit.
Did you see that, who is it that's just sampled? I think it was Drake that sampled Pet Shop Boys. West End Girls.
Yeah.
And Pet Shop Boys like tweeted the other day. It was like, oh, nice to see like Drake's like sampled this without us even knowing or being like contacted at all. I'm like, what?
Well, they don't own the don't own the original.
Really?
So if you don't own, like, the labels can do what the fuck they want.
That's nuts. That's just madness.
Yeah, it's like publishing. If you sold your catalog, which a lot of which a lot of people are doing, like if you're Calvin, you're selling your catalog for 150 million. Like, those people own, the reason why they're buying it is because they're going to make money from it. And how do they make money from it? They go and resell it and repackage it and do all of that. And I think that's, it's going to be a very interesting time. I just hope that we have more Jay-Z's, more Kanye's, more Eminem's, that like more Chemical Brothers that just like find obscure samples and turn them into amazing records. Because I think at this moment in time, like, you're doing it as well. Like, I don't know your process. Are you going in the studio and making your own samples, or are you sampling other people? Like, how are you doing that?
A little bit of both. A little bit of both, really. I mean, I've had loads of stuff that I've tried to clear that I haven't been able to clear.
Yeah.
That like labels or publishers are just like, nah, you can't have that. Like, I actually did a re-recording of one of the tracks on the album. And so I was able to use the publishing, but I wasn't able to use the recording. So there's like little things like that you have to get around. But a lot of the times, like, I'll just sample stuff that is around me, like whether that's I'm on a night out, I'll record stuff on my phone, or whether it's like, so I've recently rekindled with like an old college friend, and she happens to be an amazing vocalist. And so like the track that I just released, Start Again, that's all her. So, you know, she basically, I was like, oh, like, if you ever like record any stuff, like, just like send it over like on your phone or whatever. And literally like the next day she'd recorded like three amazing ideas. I was like, oh, okay. Like, didn't expect that.
Yeah.
And then I like made it, you know, started to collaborate with her on it. And then we went back and forth with like lyric ideas. And
Is that Natasha Fox?
Yeah. That's it. Yeah.
Cool.
So yeah, like that just felt very, very organic. Cause it's like, I know her, like I've had like a friendship and stuff. So it was just felt really cool way of working. Like, I love doing that. Like, things that just happen like naturally, and you just didn't know that was going to be the end result. Like, it's not like you've gone in the studio with a purpose. It was more just like, oh, like we happened to like, she came to a gig basically. Yeah. I hadn't seen her for like a decade. And, I was like, oh, wicked, like, oh, you know, kind of like shooting the breeze and stuff. And then before you know it, like, she's like sending me like vocal ideas. So, and cool. it just felt like really fun to do.
Go on, carry on.
So, yeah, so I was just going to say, like, that having samples that you can use like that for me, like, the best. Mm. Like, I love being able to, like, have samples that are very, like, personal to me and, like, true to what I am going through or what I've experienced in that moment. Like, that's the thing about this album. Like, it just feels like a musical journal in a way to me. Like, a lot of, like, there's loads of hidden stuff on there. Like, there's a track called Heaven that's just got loads of stuff that's personal to me and samples that I found, you know. So yeah, I like to do it like that. Like, I don't use, not that there's anything wrong with Splice, but I don't use Splice because it's just never really like inspired me.
Yeah.
To be honest.
That's fair. I think, like, I've used Splice previously and multiple times for like certain things, but there's also, like, for me, if I'm songwriting, like, I'm not trying to take a song that somebody else can use. Like, some of my biggest records have been a splice sample. Like, one of my records, You Take Me Higher, was like a splice sample. But like, for me, it's more so like, I want to create something that's for me, and then hopefully other people like it.
Yeah, and I don't think there's anything wrong with however anyone makes music. You know, it's there's no rules. I think it's just whatever. Like, I'm a sensitive guy. I like doing things in a weird way, and I like people being involved in my music that I have a connection with.
Yeah,
because that's just, for whatever reason, like, that just works for me. But if you can take a vocal sample from wherever and splice or whatever sample pack and make a hit out of it, I mean, credit, like. That's another like difficult thing to do, I think, to be able to turn, spin something into a great track.
I totally agree, mate. We've just done an hour and 20 minutes. We should probably wrap this up. It's gone very fucking quick. Thanks so much for coming on. How can people get involved with the Model Man kind of crew? How can people listen to the album? Tell the people where they can find you.
So come to shows. I'm playing in February. I'm going to be in Dublin. I'm going to be in Amsterdam. I'm going to be in Copenhagen. I'm going to be all up and down the country. So yeah, check out my dates then. And then, you know, of course, like, listen to the new album. Like, the vinyl is going to be printed early next year. And then, you know, stream it on all the usual places. Check out the YouTube videos. I've got a really cool guy, Liam, his name is, who does all my visuals and like videos and stuff, and we put a lot of like energy and thought into that, to sort of, so like, yeah, all the little pseudo videos that accompany the music, like, you can check all those out on YouTube and that kind of thing. So
nice one, man.
Yeah, thanks
for coming on. Keep doing it, man.
Thanks for having me.
I'm loving what you're doing. Keep it up, and I'm sure I'll see you soon.
Cheers, Will.
Peace, mate. Thank you.
See you, mate.
And that's a wrap. Big love to everybody for coming and listening. Please hit subscribe, get involved in the Discord. See you next time.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.